All right, we are here live. We're here with Vikram, who is an Atheist Republic patron. Thank you so much for being an Atheist Republic patron. Guys, if you guys, if anyone else want to schedule a call with me as a patron, link in the, is in the description. Message me. The instructions on how to set this up is in the description. Reach out to me and we could have calls like this. Vikram wanted to talk about Hindu nationalism and responsible platforming, like whether when we talk about extremists, when we talk to them, should we platform them, not platform them, should we talk to them, should we ignore them? And he wanted to also talk about a few other things, which we will get to if we have time. We're live streaming this on my personal channel, Armin Navobi, and then we'll republish it later on Atheist Republic's YouTube channel, and we're also live streaming on our Atheist Republic Twitch. Link to all of that is in the description. So if you're watching this on Atheist Republic, also hop on over on Armin Navobi's YouTube channel in case we ever get removed from Atheist Republic. We could hang out here, right? Anyways, hi Vikram.
Hello, how are you, Armin?
Good, good. How are you? We haven't talked for a while now.
Yeah, has it been a year now?
I don't know. We've been messaging each other, but haven't talked. Yeah. You send me compliments here every once in a while. It's very nice. I look forward to your messages. It's
nice. I feel like everything you and I could have disagreed on, we've gone so hard on those stuff, but there's only good stuff that I can tell you now.
Really? Okay, wait. So, what do you mean?
Like, every big issue you and I, not an issue, but like every disagreements we've had in the past, like we've gone so hard on those topics that everything else that remains is only stuff we agree on or stuff that I kind of think you did great on.
Okay. All right. So, you lead the way. What are we talking about?
So, like I said, Hindu nationalism, but it might just go into Hinduism as well. So it will just go like, it's whatever. So the first, I wrote down a bunch of arguments, so we could go through them. Mm-hmm. The first one, I just wanted to talk about my experience coming from like a Hindu background. Like the country I come from is it's a secular country, but there's a lot of this Hindu kind of, it's like Hindus are the majority there. And among the people, there's this kind of sense of superiority, but it's a bit strange because it's not like people are thinking out their arguments and they aren't being like, oh, I'm a Hindu. We all like, we're superior for all these reasons. It's not like, it's not this well thought out, but it's very normalized, if that makes sense.
Which country?
Mauritius.
Okay. All right. So kind of like a sense of superiority just because.
Yeah. I'm from the Hindu background, but I wouldn't be surprised if like a Muslim or a Christian or anyone else would also feel that way, but for their particular branch.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I remember when, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt if you had to say anything.
No, just continue. Just, yeah, go on.
Like I remember when I was home, like maybe back when I was 12, 13 or whatever, like sometimes we talk with other Hindus. I'm not a Hindu anymore, but like back then. I would talk to some Hindus, like we'd get along, they seem like the nicest person on earth, and then at one point they'll just slip in some sentences that, you know, it feels innocuous, but when you really hear what they are saying, you're like, wait a second. Like I remember I would talk with some people in my family, and Bill would slide in, oh yeah, have you heard of like what this black guy did? It's very strange, right? And then like you won't think much of it, and then a bit later, yeah, these black people, I tell you. Or like, you know, they'll bring in, oh, Muslims? Like, yeah, this one person, she's a Muslim, right? Like, I remember I was this weird situation. I went to like a water park back home. Mm-hmm. And like, I put my shoes on her table. She was like the cashier. And she insulted me. She was like, you shouldn't be putting your shoes there. I apologized, removed my shoes. And then she looked at my name. She's like, oh, you're a Hindu. You should have told me. I thought you were Muslim. And I was like, okay. Okay, I'm gonna walk away.
Wow, I have an experience like that somewhere else that I can't tell, but I have two experiences like that when it comes to. I was trying to buy something, and I can't tell when and where, but they asked me if I'm a Muslim because they don't sell to Muslims. And I said, no, I'm not. And I'm like, yeah, because nobody would buy from us if we sell to Muslims. But I also have an experience because I dated for a while. I dated a Hindu girl, Fijian Hindu girl. And her mother wanted to make sure I'm not a Muslim. She didn't care that if I was a Hindu or not. She didn't matter. I could be atheist, Christian. She just like, are you sure you're not a Muslim? Like, you're from, originally were born in Iran. I'm like, no, I'm not a Muslim. I'm like, are you ever going to become a Muslim? Like, go back to being a Muslim. I go like, no, like, and then like, it was weird to me because usually if you're an atheist, people have a problem with you that you're an atheist, right? But they did not care what religion you were as long as you were not a Muslim. Like, all of them, Hindu, Christian, atheist, Buddhist, nothing. We could be Satanist, didn't care, just not a Muslim. My daughter, they're like, my daughter shouldn't be dating a Muslim. That was like, yeah, that was my experience.
With if it was a strange thing, my one of my previous roommates and I, we were joking about this, but so back when I was in first year, I was in my, I call it the peak, kind of the angry atheist phase, the phase where you're super obnoxious about it. And we were joking about how, like, back then, so I've never really been in a relationship with women and stuff. I've always just have like one night stands and stuff like that. And we were joking about how so many girls that I would sleep with, they turned out to be super religious. And like, they would have like, they would be super crazy women, not in the bad way. Like, I don't mean, sorry, I should have phrased that better. I meant that they were into stuff that was super out there. And my roommate was joking about how, like, he, I guess he's agnostic, but he doesn't really care about the issue. I don't know what term he would use, but he would joke about how, like, every girl he has sex with were all atheists, and they didn't have any such like crazy kind of, not crazy, but they didn't have such like out there, like, you know.
That's the only thing, you know, sometimes when, you know, a lot of times people ask me, I mean, is there anything good about religion? And I always say, no, there's nothing good about religion. But if I have to be honest, that's the only thing that is good about religion is that, you know, it gives us, I don't know how to say it without getting canceled, but yeah, people that making this taboo for many years has given us a lot of twists and that we could enjoy. I don't know how else to say that, but yes, I agree.
Like, there was some, all right, is it okay if I share one story? It's quite funny. Like, I don't know if you have like restrictions in terms of like content, but you want to talk about
it? No, go ahead.
Like, there was this girl, like, she was like the first person I had sex with. It was like maybe 5 years ago now. We go into her room. She has like a Jesus cross, like a huge cross on her wall. And we, like, I don't know, at one point she had like a bunch of books, and I think I brought up that I was reading Richard Dawkins, and she says like, oh, I love his biology books. And then she starts ranting about Dawkins' views on atheism, and she starts trashing atheists. And so weird. So when she was giving me like a blowjob, I was looking at her Jesus cross, and I was like, if you only knew who I am, like, I don't know if you'd be happy right now.
I don't know. Maybe she would be more happy. Maybe she would like, this is like some, you know, evil stuff that we're doing. I don't know. Again, I don't, yeah, I the people that have never seen sex as a taboo, I don't know. It to me, it seems like they don't appreciate. It just doesn't seem like, I think, I don't know. Maybe this is wrong to say because it's, a lot of people suffer from sex shaming, feeling that they're doing something wrong, feeling disgusting. But sometimes I feel like maybe all those years of suffering we go through is worth it, because it becomes, when we actually get liberated from it, I feel like we enjoy it a lot more than people that never saw it. But the people who never saw it as anything bad or something to be ashamed of, they just like treat it like, oh yeah, like just like having a meal or something, right? And I feel like we who went through all the sex negativity and the shaming, I think we appreciate it in a way that people who never had that kind of... It's the same thing with freedom, I think, right? This is a similarity between sex and freedom, right? People who are all born under country in countries where freedom of expression was always a thing, they don't appreciate the rights that they have. They don't understand that how unique and special it is for them to be able to just say whatever they want and express themselves and be who they be openly who they want to be. They don't appreciate that, right? The people like us who came from places where you couldn't say that and now are here, we know how important it is to protect these rights, right? So I think like, yeah, I mean, it's very similar.
Yeah, just to bring it back to the like the topic of Hinduism, like I remember that...
It's okay, don't worry. It's a joke. Right? It's a joke.
Sorry. I was talking with my mom about it, and she would often share with me how my grandfather, so like her father, like how he would have a thing he would love, like trashing astrology, and sometimes he would have like Jehovah Witnesses who would knock on his door. He would bring them in his place, and he would just start debating them. So my mom was saying when she saw me go through my like my phase in atheism when I was just arguing with people like all the time about it, she was like, I reminded her of her father who would bring in Christians to debate them, and he would like he I think he believed in like a form of Hinduism that was considered more progressive, not progressive politically progressive, but progressive in terms of like they didn't believe as many crazy things as other Hindus did.
Mm.
Sorry, I just tried
yeah.
the.
Yeah, don't worry. I'll just highlight them. Don't sure. you continue saying what you're saying. I'm highlighting some of the comments.
And that's something I wanted to talk to you about. So I was listening to.
Wait, can I actually respond to some of these comments because people are misunderstanding me? Sony saying so is Armin saying that sex is too open. If sex is too open, it loses its speciality. No. Some Adam is saying, turns out Armin still has some conservatism in him. He turned bashful when guests talked about his sex. No, guys, you guys are completely... No, I think sex should be open as possible could be. There should be no taboos. There should be no shame. I just think that the people that went through the shaming, through the demonization, and through all the self-disgust, I think we just have a better appreciation for how good it is for sex, for the lack of sex negativity, for the openness, for there not being any shaming. I think like we enjoy it a little bit more because we know how bad it is when you don't have that, right? So I think it should be like this. I just think like we enjoy it more, right? Just because, like, if I'm starving to death and all of a sudden you put a lot of food in front of me and I enjoy it more than any meal that I ever had in my life, that doesn't mean that, oh, this was such a great experience. We should starve people close to death so that they could enjoy food like this. No, that's not what I'm saying. I think people should have access to food. Just because I feel like I enjoyed this more than anyone else could enjoy a meal, that doesn't mean that everybody should go through the experience of being starved to death just to have this pleasure. Anyways, go, Vikram.
But so when I was talking with my mom about it, I started figuring out even as a kid that whenever some people would use like religious arguments in general conversations, a lot of time those people don't really believe in those arguments. It's just an excuse they use. Like what they believe in is something that's deeper that. And the arguments is just like a shield to protect whatever they believe in. Like, for example, there's a celebration called Diwali, and my mom would always say that we only cook certain specific Indian sweets for Diwali, and we never cook them before because when we cook it, first we give it to God, and then we eat it. But for some reason, we were only able to give those sweets to God for Diwali. I hated everything about Diwali except the sweets. Because all we do is eat them. Eventually, so I left religion, and my mom's not really like She is whatever she is, but she's not too into religion anymore. So I was talking to her about it. I was like, listen, we're not, I wasn't thinking grade 12 at that point. We're not really religious anymore. We can just cook those sweets whenever we want. And then she told me like, hey, the reason that I told you that is because those sweets take so much time to make that I didn't want to do them more than once a year, just because like I didn't want to go through the hassle of it. And
oh, that's a clever move. Oh, that's like, clever.
I was like, what? Oh, like, yeah. This whole time, like I've been waiting like for a whole year just for that one time.
That's like, son, I have to tell you something. That is such a friend. That's good. Like, mom, we're not religious anymore. We can have these sweets anytime we want. Like, son, I have to tell you something. That's good. That's good. That's a good story. That's okay.
And so that's, I said this as a joke, but to bring it to more serious stuff now, that's why I feel like debating theists is ultimately pointless, because they don't, like, if you debunk each argument they make, all they'll do is that they'll come up with a different argument. But the argument itself is not why they believe. Like, if let's say you explain why the Kalam cosmological argument is flawed, no one will start rethinking their theism as a result of that. They'll just find another argument. They'll look into like Thomas Aquinas, or they'll look into like some random person.
Right.
Like, what do you think of that?
No, I mean, I think the arguments for the existence of God, if you look at them, if you remove all the philosophical fluff around them, they're so childishly stupid that the only way to make them seem intelligent is to confuse the reader by dressing them up in seemingly nuanced and like using uncommon vocabulary and complicated sentence structure to make something so dumb and so basic seem somehow intelligent. But they are, once you remove all that dressing, what you're left with is so pathetically and obviously dumb that it's amazing. It's not just the fact that we have an answer to all of them. It's the fact that, to me, it's bizarre that they're even given any credit to seem like, to even call them philosophical arguments, I think it's like it's a shame to whatever is labeled philosophy to be able to even include that in, if that is included as a category, can be categorized as philosophy, then I mean, screw philosophy. Like, what the hell is this stuff? Like, this is like, I mean, it's so basic, it's so dumb. And I think like, this is why I have given up on even arguing about it. I think like we should have moved way past all of this like ages ago. And I think like constantly debating them is giving them more credit than they deserve. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I'm only speaking from my experience. So everything I'm saying, if I say anything wrong, it's just like what I learned and what I know. So I might just be completely wrong here. But one thing also that, sorry, when I was saying this, I forgot my train of thought. We were talking about, the arguments and why it's not that important. I feel like, to me at least, before I got into like reading Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and Matt Dillahunty, which like Matt Dillahunty is the only one when it comes to atheist debates that I still watch. He's like probably my favorite, and maybe like Cosmic Skeptics a bit, but I don't know. Matt Dillahunty is like my favorite. But one thing that for me, at least, it's that none of these arguments ever convinced me to be an atheist. I had become an atheist first, and then I had looked into like a online atheism. Like, I feel I shared that story with you, but when I was 15, I think I was 14, I went to like this lake where we would pray with my mom, and I looked at the lake, and I was kind of, I think I told myself like, I don't know if this god we're praying to exists. Like, it might, but I'm not sure. So I guess, but I didn't realize I'm agnostic, but that's probably what I was. And then a year later, so I was 15 or 16, I went to the same lake to pray with my mom. And like, I wasn't like, I didn't do the like that thing. And my mom just like, she kind of slapped me on the shoulders, not strongly, but like she just tapped me on the shoulders and she was like, you should be praying right now, like pray. So I just closed my eyes. Mm-hmm. Then I opened my eyes. I looked to the left. I see my mom, like she closed her eyes and she's praying. So I put my hands back down and I was like, yeah, no, this is nonsense. There is no God. Like, I've been wasting my time these last like 16 years. Like, and I told my mom this story. Like, she just burst out laughing every time because she also didn't really believe in that stuff, but it was a cultural thing. So every year she would just pretend, but she thought that I believed in it. So she was pretending for me. Well, I was pretending for her.
You know how that's so much more common than people realize. Like, there are so many families that there's like, I've read so many coming out stories, and there are a lot of times when somebody like comes out to their brother or to their family and they're like, you know, they're like, you guys, I have to tell you, I don't believe in God. And sometimes they get shocked, like, you know, like, you don't believe in God? Like, yeah, like, I don't believe in God. I was like, I was doing it for you. And like, what, you were doing it for me? I was doing it for you. Like, when I, like, they realize, like, it's been like for the past 5 years, they've all been pretending for each other and none of them actually believe it. It's so, by the way, Hussein left you a comment. Hussein is saying, Vikram, the debates aren't for convincing who you are debating, but it does convince viewers, or at least provokes them to ask more. Yeah, I agree with that. Morta is saying, yeah, it's bizarre that people even think there are like things except that experts disagree on. We made it to be like they are on even grounds or something. Yeah, okay. Cool. All right. You want to... Oh, Morta is saying that's so wholesome. And also scary. Okay, you wanted to talk about Hindu nationalism. Can we get to that?
Yeah, I think I kind of touched on it earlier, but so I was watching your discussions with you. So I've been watching them for the last few weeks, like bits of different stuff. Hmm. A conversation with this guy. I don't know if I should say his name. Both his first name and last name begin with J. You had a conversation with him on Atheist Republic and on secular jihadists. I feel like that guy is... like, he's really smart with how he phrases his views. He phrases them in a way that it sounds very progressive and like very, like, you know, very progressive and all that. But then he kind of, he does this bait and switch where he brings in some Hindu nationalist behind every, like every, sorry, Hindu nationalist statement behind whatever he's saying. Because I don't have examples in mind right now, but there were times when you're having a conversation with him and he makes you look like you're like the bigot while he's saying some pretty bigoted statements, but he just kind of phrased in a nice way, if that makes sense.
You don't remember any examples?
Sorry, I've been doing an assignment all day. Don't worry.
Okay. But I can't respond to it if you don't remember it. So just, yeah.
There was another guy, like, he seemed like a nice guy. I don't know his name, but I think he was like a Hindu guy. He was talking about Sanatanizing religions. But at the end, I felt like what he does is that he's trying to, because he knows you're a lot, you're very secular, so he tries to phrase his views in a secular, like, oh yeah, I'm pro-secularism, but at the end he ended that discussion by talking about how he wants to Sanatanize other religions that aren't his. And and I was like, wait, you just, wait, where does that come from? Like, you know,
right.
It felt very familiar because growing up, people would do that a lot. Like, they'd be like, yeah, we got to love your neighbor and all that stuff. And then they're like, you know, those Muslims, like, you know, those black people, you know, those, like, you know, and you're like, where does that, like, you see, there's this cognitive dissonance of like, we're good people. And then you just bring in that bigotry right behind it.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because we are technically doing the same thing with our ideas, right? Because how do you say it again, Sana?
That was the first time I heard that name, so I might be saying it wrong. I think you said Sanatanize something.
No, that's like making it more I don't know what the word is. Somebody can say it maybe in the live chat, but that's making it more like Hinduism. Basically, that's what it is. Like making it compatible with Hinduism, right? It's kind of like, but maybe people say assimilate to Hindu culture. That's what it is, right? Just like what Israel, it's very similar to what's happening in Israel when they're trying to make Israel like a Jewish state. They're like, you know what? People are like, isn't that a bit racist? Like, no, because, you know, they're trying to make Judaism, like, this is the right wing people, making it Judaism to not just be a religious thing or a cultural thing or an ethnic thing, but also a nationality. And by doing that, and in a way to avoid making it seem like there's going to be a two-tier system or there any racism involved, what they're saying is that anybody could assimilate and be more Jew-like, right? And they're like, you could be an Arab and in Israel, and as long as you assimilate, you could be Jewish at heart or something. Like, I'm like, what are you guys saying? All right, so basically they want people to ask, I mean, for us that sounds pretty bad, because it is. But if you look at what we're doing, like the people who believe in enlightenment values, we are technically saying, you know, you could be a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Hindu, but as long as you don't live by Islamic values, and as long as you understand that we enlighten, you know, as long as you don't live by Islamic values or Christian values, as long as you don't want to, you know, as long as you accept that we have freedom of speech, that we accept homosexuality, we accept trans people, men and women should have equal rights, then you have the freedom to believe. As long as you don't practice those beliefs, you should be able to exist with us, right? So we technically are asking them to also assimilate, like, but we are right because our values are superior. but technically we're doing the same thing. We're telling Muslims, like, hey, you get to be Muslim, you get to believe in Allah and the Quran and Muhammad, but the values that we have here is that men and women are equal and gay people are free to be gay and secularism rules the land, and as long as you abide by these rules, you could believe whatever you want in your own private corner. Aren't we doing the same thing? What do you think?
Do you think we are, just to be sure I understand, do you think we are doing like a special pleading fallacy or like a double standard?
No, we're doing the opposite. I'm calling us out on it. So like I'm doing the opposite of it. Like I'm being transparent. I'm saying it's okay. I'm saying we have the same standard. No, we're not doing double standard. I'm saying we have the same standard, but we're okay. Because our values are superior. Oh, you're saying special pleading. Okay, it's not double standard, but it is special pleading. But it is special pleading, but it's not a fallacy because it is special. Special pleading is a fallacy if you are making the wrong claim that this is a special situation. It's not a fallacy if it's actually special. Our values are better than Islam.
But our values, so you and I mean, we have a lot in common, but let's assume we didn't know each other. So the only thing we have in common is a lack of belief in God, or in my case, like a belief that there is no God or like whatever. So what value is there in just atheism?
I wasn't talking about atheism as a value. Atheism is not a value. I was talking about the values that we defend, which is enlightenment values. Atheism is just a lack of belief in God. It doesn't come up with a value system. The value system that we here at Atheist Republic believe in is the enlightenment values, and there's a list of them.
Yeah, I got, based on your recommendation, I got the book by Steven Pinker, and like,
oh yeah,
I it's 700 pages long, and I have like so much reading to do for school. I'm waiting to be done so I can read it.
It's really good.
I don't think we're making a special pleading, because I feel like if to be a special pleading fallacy, it would maybe not fallacy, but to be a special pleading, we would have to be bringing them to atheism, which isn't what we're doing. We're just like stating that, because well, it's like a difference between a normative claim and a descriptive claim. Like, we are saying that our we're not really like, I think they are making a claim that's descriptive about reality. Well, we're making a claim about what's normative when it comes to values, if that makes sense.
Well, okay, so special pleading is not like a formal fallacy. Like, it doesn't mean that just like there are some fallacies that every time you do them, it's wrong no matter what, right? But there's some other logical fallacies that when it's whether there are sometimes that you might be doing it, but it doesn't make your argument wrong, right? For example, like slippery slope. You say sometimes like, oh, if this happens, then this is going to happen. And a lot of times like, oh, that's a slippery slope fallacy, because if this happened, that doesn't happen. If A happens, B doesn't necessarily happen. But there are situations where if A happens, B does necessarily follow, right? If A happens, B doesn't. So if I say, dude, don't do A. If you do A, B will happen. You're like, ah, slippery slope. Or like, But in this situation, B does actually follow A. So you can't just say slippery slope, right? So, and again, so for example, special pleading, you could be like, I don't know, like, you shouldn't punch people in the face. So like, and then somebody comes at me and I'm defending myself and I punch them in the face. I'm like, this was different. I like special pleading. Like, I was defending myself. Special pleading. Like, no, but this is actually different. Okay. So it is like, there are, you know, so again, that's why we have the fallacy, right? When you think like the fallacy is that you think an argument is wrong just because, you know, it has the format as one of the logical fallacies, that it doesn't, if you can find one of the logical fallacies, that doesn't necessarily mean the argument is wrong. If you think if you think that you find a logical fallacy, that means the argument is wrong, then now you're committing the fallacy.
Yeah, I notice, I have so much to say about the fallacy, but like maybe we should complete the Hinduism stuff first.
Yeah, go.
There was this weird thing when I told people I'm an atheist, where like, especially with Hindus, well, they'll tell me things like, oh, you can't leave Hinduism. Hinduism is not a religion. It's a way of life. It's a philosophy. But even if that's true, I can still choose to leave it, right? Like, it's not like, it's like once you're born in it, you can never leave. Like, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I hate that. Like, Hinduism is a way of life. It's not a religion. It's a way of life. Well, excuse me, other religions are not a way of life? Like, how does that negate one? Like, Hinduism is not a religion, it's a way of life. So is every other religion is also a way of life. What the hell? And then, it's a way of life. You can't leave it. Like, I can leave ways of life. I just don't live that way of life. Therefore, I have left that way of life.
Yeah, with Hinduism, one thing I find, like, that's very different to like Abrahamic religions, it's that you can, like, if you bring two Christians in the same room, like, they could have very different beliefs, but at their core, they all believe that, like, the Bible is the word of God and that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and stuff like that. But you can bring two Hindus in the same room and they agree on nothing. Like, that's what makes it really hard sometimes to debunk Hinduism, just because there's so many different branches.
That's a feature, that's not a bug. That's like in the, you know, it's Hinduism is the best thing ever and it's nothing at all at the same time. Just because when you want to defend it, they're like, oh, this is Hinduism and it's great. And then when you want to attack, you're like, that's not even Hinduism. It's like the, you know, in the Matrix, when you shoot bullets at it, they keep dodging it. They're like, oh, this isn't Hinduism. It's like, well, that's not necessarily Hinduism. Hinduism is so many things to so many people at the same time. But it's only like that when you attack it. All of a sudden, when you want to defend it, it becomes very specifically these things that they like. Here's the thing. If you like it, then it's part of Hinduism. If you don't like it, then who even knows what Hinduism is? Like, it's like, there's so many different things to so many different people, right?
Yeah, I know. This thing, I don't know how it is in other countries, but where I'm from at least, like, there's like an intersection between race and religion where I'm from. I feel like, because here in Canada now, like, I feel like two people that live here, brown people are all the same. Like you could bring a Muslim and a Hindu, two people like, yeah, it's just Muslims and it's brown people. But where I'm from, it's like, if you're a Hindu and if you're a Muslim, there's like a difference in terms of, like, you're looked at differently just based on that fact. And now, even though I'm an atheist, there's like, it's weird because based on my skin color and my family, people would lump me in with Hindus. And similarly, you could have like a Christian, like guy who's from like a Muslim family or like a whatever religion. And they would still technically be considered Muslim as it intersects with race, which is very weird. I don't know if like other countries have it too, but I'm guessing they must.
Wait, so what's the question?
No, it's just like a statement as it relates to Hindu nationalism. Like, it's like this weird thing where people bring race and religion together. So like, instead of saying like, in Canada, we would say like, those people are brown. Like, let's say, I'm just making a general statement.
Right.
In my country, we would say, oh, this person is a Hindu, like, is a Hindu, while the other person is a Muslim. And it's like a weird connection between race and religion.
Okay, but by the way, your caste, people are thinking you're a Brahmin, right? You were a Brahmin.
No, I was the lowest one. I don't know. I don't know the terms, but whatever is the lowest. The
outcast or the lowest caste?
The
lowest caste.
Is it Dalit?
Dalit is an outcast. Dalit is not the lowest caste. It's the outcast. It's even It's not even in the caste system.
That's what I was, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so here's the thing. I think we have the global ethnicity free religions, the two major world religions that are like that are Christianity and Islam. And then there are the two that I consider to be, I'll call them ethno religions, which is Judaism and Hinduism, right? So the ethno, it's interesting because based on my experience, a lot of people that grew up in, like, were more familiar with ethno religions, that grew up under ethno religions, they seem to have a bigger, more of a problem at separating ethnicity from religion of other people that are grew up in non-ethnic religions, right? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like, except maybe some white people who think Christianity is a white thing for some reason, they also get confused. But because a lot of, for example, Hindus consider Hinduism their religion to be in their blood, so they can't separate their religion because their religion is for a specific ethnicity. Their mind cannot comprehend that being different for other people. So they see their religion as part of their DNA, and that's why they assume other people's religion is also part of their DNA and part of their blood and part of their essence. And that's why it's not something you could necessarily change. And this is why a lot of Hindus tell me, like, Armin, you keep saying you're ex-Muslim, but we know you're Muslim by blood. Like, you know, we know, like, you're still, it's in your blood to be a Muslim, right? So this is my experience with them. So that's why I say, we're Hindu, you're Muslim, we're brown. Yeah. So they use it interchangeably, religion and ethnicity. But go on, you want to say it?
Yeah, and that's why, like, even if I were to tell some people where I'm from that, no, I'm an atheist, to them, it's like, no, like, I see you, I know your family, you're a Hindu. Hmm. They wouldn't be able to connect. Even if you convert to Christianity and stuff, like, they wouldn't, it's like in their mind, you're still like a Hindu, just based on that.
Right.
And yeah.
This is the same experience I had in Israel, right? There were this argument between different atheists in Israel, because some of them identify as atheist Jews, and some of them were like, why can't we be ex-Jews, right? And people are like, what do you mean ex-Jew? You can't be an ex-Jew, you're a Jew. You could be an atheist Jew, but you're always a Jew, right? And then the atheists were like, why can't these people be, like, look at Armin, like, he was pointing at me. He's an ex-Muslim. Why can't they be ex-Muslim? Why can't we have ex-Christians? Why I want to I identify as an ex-Jewish atheist, right? I don't want to be a Jew. I don't want to be, and they were fighting with each other over, like, are we atheist Jews or are we ex-Jewish atheists, right? And I feel like there's the same conversation happening in India. People say, like, I'm an ex-Hindu atheist or I'm a Hindu atheist. It seems to be two different crowds, right? And this is only happens with Judaism and Hinduism because they're ethno-religions. So the definition of what it means to be a Hindu and what it means to be a Jew is the same conversation that's happening in India is happening in Israel, right? Because they're, again, the three traditionally definitions of what it means to be a Jew or Hindu were culture, ethnicity, or religion. And these are three separate things. And it seems like both countries at the same time are adding a fourth definition. And they seem like they're copying each other. The fourth definition that is coming in both countries is nationalism, right? It's the nationality, right? So this is a modern definition of these words. To make it seem like, oh, being a Jew it means to be Israeli, and being Israeli means to be a Jew, or being a Hindu, being an Indian means to be Hindu, right? So they're trying to add, if both of these countries, because their ethno-religions are very powerful tools for ethno-nationalism. So both of these countries are now, the right-wing parties in both of these countries are now trying to add this fourth definition to it, which is very interesting.
Yeah, and it's very strange, but the more I think about it, especially like when we were growing up, so when they would think of like people who are Catholics, where I'm from, like Catholic, I don't know what it's that word, they would usually use that as a dog whistle for Black people, which was very strange. And I don't know, I'm guessing like Western countries don't really do that. But then I've seen like a lot of like Richard Spencer, for example, he's an atheist, but he believes in we need Christianity to preserve like white skin. So maybe it's like a global thing. I'm not sure.
It's very interesting because if you look at the far right, there's two different, when it comes to the far right using religion, there's a lot of people on the far right that don't even want to use religion, but the ones that do want to use religion, a lot of them are atheists, but they think the religion is too powerful of a tool for them to abandon, right? If you look at the Western far right, they're looking at other far right movements like Islam and Hinduism, and they feel like they're failing compared to them, right? They're looking at Muslims and see that their far right movements are a lot more, they're winning, they're growing, they're winning, they're a lot more powerful. They're looking at Hindutva. The rise of the far right is happening mostly in India and with Islam. Western far right movements are like pathetically small and weak compared to them, right? And they're looking at them and they see that they have what they're doing effectively is demographic engineering, controlling women, higher birth rates, and a very effective use of religion. Even when it comes to anti-Islamic far-right movements in Iran, ethno-nationalist movement in Iran that are anti-Islamic, they are using Zoroastrianism and ancient symbols to grow and find solidarity, right? And if you look at white far-right movements, they don't have that. They don't have that because Christianity, it's very interesting because Christianity came from the people that they hate the most, right? It came from Jewish people, and this has caused a division between them because some of them want to use it because they know religion is such a powerful tool. A lot of them want to use it, like, look, this is the white man's religion, we could use it. And the other half is like, no, this is like a conspiracy, this is like it's a Jewish thing, it came from Judaism, and that's what we hate the most. Like, this is a conspiracy, like, how are we falling for this? Of course we shouldn't be even touching this, right? And that's why some of them are trying to use Norse mythology symbolism, because that was definitely a white man's religion, right? They were going back to the Viking symbology. This is why the people, the pagans, who are actually originally part of these pagan movement, you know, religions, they hate that, which is very interesting, because if you look at the pagans in Europe who actually believe in Norse mythology and that's like part of their heritage, they hate the fact that some far-right groups are now using their symbolism as a way to grow their movement, which is exactly what's happening in Iran, because that the people who were born Zoroastrians and Zoroastrianism is part of their religion and culture, they're now noticing that a lot of ethno-nationalists are now jumping on Zoroastrian symbolism to grow their movement and use it as a political tool. And they don't want anything to do with that. I mean, they already are getting a lot of persecution from the government for just being non-Muslim. And now if their if their religion and symbols are used as a political tool against Islam, they're going to feel like a lot more backlash than they were even getting before. So they were like trying to distance themselves from it as much as possible. But it's very interesting how similar things happen in different parts of the planet, independent from each other and in a very similar way.
Yeah, there is an argument that I know, like, Destiny made it, but I think he made it in his conversation with you. But it's something that I don't really get it myself. When like Destiny talked about, I think Sean Carroll talked about it too, but he said that, sorry, I'm trying to phrase it right. He said that even if we don't believe, there is something in religion that unites people together, and atheism has yet to really find a replacement for that. Like, but he believes that in the future, and I think Sean Carroll believes that too, we will find like a secular way of uniting people in a way that doesn't require believing in some like imaginary sky thing.
Wait, he's saying that will he's saying eventually we will find something like that under secularism?
I think, you know, I don't know if he said we will. I think he said he hopes we will. Because by what I understand, like, that's like the failure of secularism that people usually bring up, that we haven't found a good replacement. And with right. the different religions, we lose that community building.
So let me address that, because that's this annoys the hell out of me. When people say that, when they say atheism doesn't offer this, atheism doesn't offer that, as if it's supposed to offer anything other than the answer to one goddamn question, right? If you, for example, if you ask me like, hey, Armin, is it true that 2 + 2 = 5? And I'm like, no. And they're like, well, your answer to this question, your no answer to my question, doesn't suck my dick. It doesn't offer me that. I'm like, well, it's not supposed to. You asked me a question, and the answer to that question was no. I'm like, well, I wish this answer did more than just a no. I wish it would suck my dick as well for me. Like, I wish it did that for me. I'm like, well, it's not gonna, okay? You asked me a question, and that's the answer, right? So I don't understand when people say, like, hey, well, is there a God? Is there a conscious creator of universe? I was like, no, there's no evidence for that. I was like, well, this doesn't give me this. It doesn't provide community. It doesn't provide symbolism. It doesn't provide give me hope. It doesn't give me a meaning to life. It doesn't provide me spirituality. It doesn't give me confidence. I'm like, what the hell? What did you expect from? You ask the question, is there evidence for the existence of God? And the answer is no. What you want all of those things, well, you're not going to get that from the answer to this question. You go get that somewhere else. Let me give you another example, okay? Here's a better example, right? Let's say I get insurance, right, for my house, okay? And then my house burns down, and I go and ask the insurance for money, and I realize it was a fraud, and they are like, as soon as my house burned down, they completely ignore everything. No responses to my messages, phone call, nothing. I was caught, okay? And now, Vikram, you going there, you're trying to get insurance for your house, and I noticed you're going for the same company. And I'm going to tell you, like, Vikram, this is a fraud. Don't go with this company. This is a lie. don't buy insurance from them. And then you come to me like, oh, that's, they don't, okay, then Armin, you give me insurance. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm not an insurance company. Go find insurance somewhere else. Like, no, you're telling me that they have, this is a fraud, so you should give me insurance. Like, I don't have insurance for you. I'm just telling you that this is not it. You go do research, go find somewhere else, insurance somewhere else. I'm just telling you that this is not it. So when we come, this is basically what the atheist movement and the atheist activism is supposed to do. We're telling people, this is not a good source of meaning. This is not a good source of community. This is not a, this does not provide the answers that you want. And they're like, okay, you telling us that this is not the answers we want, then you should tell, give us the answer. Like, well, maybe I can, but maybe I can't. Your response, now that you know that this doesn't provide you the those, the meaning, the community, the purpose, all those things that you were looking, the sense of spirituality, the sense of belonging to a higher cause or whatever, all those desires, those needs that are there, I'm telling you that this is not it. Now you could go. The thing is that the answer to those questions could be different from all of us. We could find, like, I don't have a universal answer for you because there is no universal answer to it. Like, what I'm going to, in fact, this is an opportunity for you to realize where I'm going to go find the answer to those desires could be completely different from where you're going to find it. So now that you've been freed from these shackles, you could go do research and figure out what's a healthier way to satisfy these desires, right? But you can't be like, oh, here's the universe. I'm not going to give you a universal answer, okay? I'm going to suggest, make you, I'm going to tell you where I'm getting them from. And you could see if it maybe works for you as well. You know, but if I do tell you where I'm getting it from, that's not part of atheism. The part that was atheism was just me telling you that this is bull crap. Now, if I'm giving you, like, if I'm telling you, okay, here are now the values that I think it works, right? That's not something else. This is something on top. This is something extra. This is bonus, right? This is why I'm saying we believe in enlightenment values. But that is not our atheism. This is on top of our atheism. This is an addition to our atheism, right? We suggest that going for enlightenment values make the world a better place for a lot more people, but that is not atheism. In fact, you could be a religious person that believes in enlightenment values, and you could be an atheist that doesn't believe in enlightenment values, okay? These are separate things. What do you think?
Can I play devil's advocate?
Yeah, please. Oh, interesting.
I'll put my theist hat from back when I was 10 years old on. So let's use your analogy, right? So you see, I'm going to this insurance company. You run up to me. You're like, hey, don't go there. It sucks. I tell you, hey, I need insurance. Can you give me insurance? To which you say, no, I don't have insurance. Then I know this one might suck, but at least it's giving me that insurance that I need. And so ultimately, even if it's not great, it's not even good, at least I'm getting some form of insurance. It's like a little bit is better than none. So now, to make it out of the analogy and just be more clear, it's like when you discard religion, you're not only discarding the belief in the supernatural, you're also discarding all the values that people find in it. So it's like, what are you replacing those values with?
Wait, what if it's what's giving you is a net negative? What if you're contributing money to it, and then when your house burns down, they give you nothing? So it's not better than nothing. It's worse than nothing.
But is it not providing you with a community building, with a sense of purpose, with, I don't know, what people like
that? No, it's not, because what it's doing, because this is the assumption that basically is destroying the competition, which would have been a lot better. Like, if you look at whenever you take these out of a society, religion out of society, people are not gonna, you don't get the situation where people don't have a sense of community. They don't have like if you look at countries where, you know, if you look at, for example, Scandinavian countries, right? Do you think people there are not finding ways to find community, purpose, meaning? Like, it gets replaced by something else like this. In fact, what these religions are doing is not, they're not providing a service that would not be there if they weren't existing. What they're doing is that they're making you believe that you need them for those, to satisfy those desires, but they're crushing the competition, either because it's mandated by law or because they have unfair legal and tax privileges that other methods don't get, right? I mean, when you are feeling depressed, you're going talking to a priest that has no idea about anything about psychology. Maybe if you're depressed because, I don't know, you're gay, he's telling you, it's going to tell you that's a sin. I mean, their source of reference is like the Goatherder's Guide to the Galaxy, ancient books that shouldn't be used for anything other than enjoying mythology, right? They're using that as a reference to come up with answers to things that they have no credentials or business answering to, right? And what they're doing is that they are making you get not just like, this is a worse situation. Like, they're giving you bad advice. They're making you waste your time and resources. And if they were not there, the demand for community, the demand for a sense of belonging or a sense of purpose will create a situation where it would be supplied by the society or by the market, right? In much more efficient, much more modern, much more science-based ways, and in much more compatible to use individually, rather than something that is like supposed to be like, here's the answer to this entire giant group of people, right? Like, if you want community, imagine if your church wasn't there, you might be like, you know what, I'm gonna go join a knitting club or a running club or a music club or a hiking club, like something that fits your personality or more your, I don't know, or a gaming community, whatever. It would be more in line with you and finding people that you share, or philosophy, chess club, right? I don't know, you find something that is much more meaningful, much more interesting to you, much more in line with your personality. And if you have like psychological help need, imagine if all the tax that was being, because all the tax revenue that is being missed out on from all these churches was like, you know, you had more government funded, psychological mental help to people that are feeling alone or depressed, that you actually get to talk to people that are giving you advice based on our best understanding of these mental issues, right? Rather than talking to a priest. Like, why would you even, like, so I think it is, there's a cost associated with, there's an opportunity cost associated with this. These people, especially because these religions are, they don't come at no cost. It's not like zero or them. They come out at the cost of crushing the competition with the unfair privileges that they have. We would have gotten a lot more if they weren't around.
Yeah. You said what I would have responded to it, but you said it in a much better way. You went to more examples than I could think of. Like, for me, I would just have said, like, no, I think we can find better things, because ultimately all the bads that religion give, you could replace, like, you could get, also all the goods that religion give, you could get from other sources without the bad. But yeah, you said it in a much better way.
Thank you.
Do you want to get to the responsible platforming
part? Yes, let's do that. Let's get to that one. Because
we're right. So let me go through my, I wrote some arguments. So I'll begin by saying why I agree with you. I don't know, maybe we agree on everything, but so I agree that there are some people who would say that people who have heinous views should never be platformed, because even if you challenge them, you're still promoting them to, you're making part of your audience susceptible to them. I don't agree with that. I feel like there are people that you platform on, like, you can platform anybody on, whether they are flat earthers, like far right crazies, like whatever, so long as you are effectively challenging them. Because if you fail to do that, you're opening your audience to being misled by them. And I thought of this example that it seems to make sense to me, at least. Like, for back when I was 16, 17, when I was this rebellious guy who didn't really understand much about the world, you put someone like Ben Shapiro, or you put some crazy person like Richard Spencer, or like, you put anyone like that who's wearing a suit, sounds really nice, they might be saying complete nonsense. But to me, who doesn't know any better, I would be easily susceptible to falling into their stuff, just because I don't know anything about the world, but they sound really smart saying complete bullshit. So unless you provide someone else to challenge them and point out how bad their ideas are, it is responsible to platform them.
Yeah, especially because I've noticed these people, a lot of these people, in when they do get pushed into the deepest, darkest parts of the internet where there's no backlash to what they're seeing, and when people discover them there, they are, I've seen people go from just being curious to all of a sudden agreeing with them after a short period of time, and I've seen the difference between that and when they see the backlash, right? Because of the lack of a backlash to the things that they're saying, you know, I think there's a huge, I mean, psychologically also, a lot of people just want to be, they don't want to be on the side that people are pointing and laughing at, right? So a lot of these people, if they were saying the things that they were saying in platforms that had a lot more normal people respond, like a lot more of an audience, a lot more mainstream, just the backlash to them, for example, right? The wokies are not being canceled, right? But the far right is being canceled a lot, right? They've been kicked out of all these platforms, right? And if you look at...
I think I disagree. I feel like people on the left, like, cancel each other way more than they cancel...
I mean by genuine cancel. Not like, cancel as in, like, remove all your accounts, remove suspended from Twitter. Not like cancel as in calling each other out. Like, actual cancel, right? If you look at what's happening, is that the wokey ideas are becoming a laughingstock because they're becoming more and more popular for people to point and laugh, and not being canceled and being exposed for everybody to see makes them less cool to hang out with. Like a lot of teenagers, like they see one side making like some calling somebody racist and they're looking at everybody laughing at them for calling somebody racist. Like you want to be on the side of the crowd that is pointing and laughing rather than the side that you look so ridiculous, right? So you notice this, what's happening, you're like, yeah, I'm going to go on that side, right? But if you go to these young like teenagers, when they discover the far right talking points, they usually discover them on platforms where they're not mainstream. It's not like Facebook, and because they've been kicked out of those places, and they notice these people saying some edgy stuff, but they don't have the backlash. They don't see people, like they're not exposed to the people pointing and laughing and saying, oh my God, this is insanely ridiculous. They don't see that anymore. They just only see the far right person making the edgy comment, and they think this is cool. And they have removed them being exposed, because they will be discovered no matter how much you remove them, they will be discovered, especially because a lot of people are looking for stuff that has been banned, have been removed. Like they want to go discover them. What is this that is being banned? Why is this not on Facebook, right? Why is this not on Twitter? Why is this not on YouTube? And they go and discover them, and they just listen to them in a vacuum where the reaction is not there anymore. And another thing that it does, by the way, is that if you look at the far right, a lot of them have learned how to present themselves in a way where they don't get removed from these platforms. And all you do is that the ones that are not very strategic, they're most insane one of them, right? Because they're not very clever. They are getting removed from all these platforms. And the only ones that are remaining are the ones that know how to talk so effectively, and they're much better at communication, and they stay. And they're still spreading those ideas, but they're spreading them in a lot more clever way. But when you look at, for example, the wokey side, where they're not getting canceled and removed from the platform, you got the nuanced ones, that the ones that know how to talk academically, but they're surrounded by a lot of screeching, wokey, not like a lot of people that just makes their entire movement seem insane. They stay on these platforms, right? So most people look at them and look at the entire thing and like, oh my God, you guys are insane. But it's interesting because the far right people, they also have a lot of insane people surrounding the ones that know how to communicate, but a lot of like really, really, really obviously, openly, transparently, explicitly crazy racist takes, for example, but they're not there anymore. So when you look at their movement on mainstream platforms, they look a lot more clean and polished and more nuanced, and they seem a lot more intelligent, right? To a lot of people that are just comparing them, right? Just because it's not that they're not there, it's just that you removed them, you just took away all their crazies, and they now look a lot more intelligent to a teenager that doesn't even know better. Just like, these people are crazy, these people sound sane, right? So that's another side effect that that you know you get from, you know, not platforming. I mean, I think, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. The argument that I found for platforming that seems to be, not platforming, sorry, for deplatforming, but seems to be, I guess, what I find to be quite convincing, it's about, if we use the example of Milo Yiannopoulos, back when I was in 2015, my peak anti-SJW phase, Milo was like the big guy, like he was roasting Ben Shapiro, he was like demolishing some students who were super nervous and unprepared to debate him. He was like going on Dave Rubin. He was going everywhere. He was like the big guy. But then people started like, when the right deplatformed him, essentially his career is over. He had a debate with Destiny.
That's different.
A lot of himself. He goes around like, he just loses debates nowadays. And he's apparently recently he's been like going hard anti-Trump now, just because he feels like the right has like trashed him or something, I don't know. But yeah, okay. He's an example of deplatforming working.
He's the favorite example of it working because he's one of the only examples working. That's why everybody who wants to show, that's why everybody who wants to come up with the counter, like I say, like deplatforming usually doesn't work, right? It usually has a lot of negative side effects. It doesn't achieve, and people sometimes like, oh, look at this person, they don't have any the reach that they used to have before. But you have to compare the effect that it had on that specific person rather compare it to the effect that it has on the movement, because the movement, just because one person is now less relevant than a whole, that doesn't mean the movement as a whole is suffering that much, right? Milo is a favorite example of everybody because he lost everything. Like he doesn't have a fraction of the reach he used to have. But if you look at his specific take, his example, it wasn't because of him being canceled from these platforms and because of the far right things that he was saying. It was specifically because he said something that both the right and the left and the far right and the far left will, you know, he said he endorsed something that was a taboo for all sides. Everybody, like people were like, yeah, get rid. Like it wasn't just that he was deplatformed. It was also that people didn't want him anymore, right? If the situation was that he was deplatformed and people, he had diehard supporters that were against his deplatforming, they will have followed him to wherever he went, right? They would have followed him. They would have introduced other people to him. They would have become more emboldened to spread his message to people, to red pill people, to him. And he would have become a lot more, maybe he would have had a smaller reach, but he would have made more financially, because more people would support him because he doesn't have the reach that he used to have, right? And more people would feel privileged and honored to be one of the few people that have access to him in these places that other people don't go. But for him, the situation was different because he was deplatformed, and also everybody was like, good, get rid of him. Even a lot of his followers were like, after what he said, were like, okay, we don't want you anymore, right? So that's not a very good example of deplatforming working. If you actually look at it overall, the people that were demanded to be removed most of them are a lot bigger because of all those demands and all those attempts, right? I mean, how did Ben Shapiro make his career? How did Jordan Peterson become so big? How did, like, all of these people became so big because people were trying to remove them from different platforms, and that's how they got the attention that they got. I mean, even me, for example, right? A lot of people found out about me because I was canceled. My speech at the university was canceled, and then I went on TV and a radio show because of that cancellation. They tried to come after us in Malaysia and tried to close down our consulate in Malaysia, and then we got on the news because of that. They are trying to remove our blasphemous cartoons, and now we became trending. Atheism trended in became trending in India for the first time in history because of that. They're taking our case to the Supreme Court in India because of them trying to. I mean, a lot of people in India discovered Atheist Republic because they were trying to remove us from all these platforms. So, for one example that everybody has, Milo. I mean, for one example like that, I have like so many examples, so many counterexamples for how it backfired instead of working.
Yeah. By my personal belief, it's that partial deplatforming leads to the person becoming bigger. But if you're able to fully deplatform them, you effectively like lower their reach. I remember, was it Sargon who had an experience where he was, I don't know if it was Sargon or it might have been someone else, but I think it was Alex Jones actually. But anyway. So someone, like, when you remove YouTube, you remove Facebook, you remove Instagram, you remove like Twitter or whatever platform, when you remove all these big platforms, if you go on BitChute, if you go on DLive or whatever, your reach is not going to be anywhere near as big just because people don't use those platforms. So maybe before you could have reached 1 million people, now you're reaching 10K people, and you can really make a living off that smaller platform that's not as good as the others and doesn't have the same reach.
Right. I think there needs to be like some scientific analysis on this. If that is true, then so basically you're saying like if you're trying to deplatform somebody, it better work, because if it doesn't work, then it's going to backfire. You better nuke them out of every platform, or else it's going to, I don't know. So would you want to take that risk if you're not 100% successful, now you made them a lot bigger? Like, I don't know, like what would be the responsible thing to do? Because now you're risking making them a lot bigger than before if you're not 100% successful, right?
With deplatforming Stefan Molyneux, considering the actual harm he has caused with turning people into incels, pushing people down the far right, like the alt-right side of things and stuff like that?
So it depends on what you mean. Like, are you talking about just private companies removing them from their platforms, right? You're not talking any government any legal consequences. You're just talking about different.
At the first step, maybe just private, but especially considering someone like Stefan Molyneux, who is actually super harmful, why even go to the like government level? I feel like there's a strong case to be made for that as well.
I don't endorse anything legal consequences, but I could see a case being made for. I think like when it comes to Facebook and YouTube, I would recommend having the community standards be a lot. I mean, I lost my Twitter account. I'm suspended on Twitter because sharing blasphemous cartoons. Like, I mean, right now it seems like it's ridiculously easy to get suspended. I mean, no nudity, nothing. Here's your goddess, and now I don't have a Twitter account. So that seems like, I think whatever. Their line should be a lot, you know, higher than to get this easily removed, right? But I do agree that I don't think it should be like, I don't know. I don't know. I think I need more evidence, more data to come up with what the line should be, you know, for private companies. I think right now it's too easy to get it's too easy. They're removing too many people for not enough good. I mean, again, I don't think this is a violation of free speech, but I still think it's a bad idea. I do think that these platforms might have to be like a public utility, but does that mean that anything goes? I don't know. Actually, I'm going to say that for me to come up with, you know, right now me and you are just guessing. Would this be harmful? Would it be not harmful? What's the benefit? What's the cost? I think like we need access to a lot more numbers and analysis to be able to do a cost benefit analysis of this, right? I mean, the cost is that, you know, people say sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? I do think like you might be doing a disservice to everybody if you don't equip them with the tools to tackle these ideas, and also not to expose how common, like a lot of people, for example, like I have a hard time explaining to people how bad of a problem like far right ideas are, right? Because they're not exposed to it. Like a lot of people are not even treating it like a serious threat because they don't see it on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, right? They think, well, you know, they think that wokeism is a bigger problem, and it's not. It's the far right ideas are a lot more toxic and a lot more dangerous, and they're very common. But it's really hard for me to convince people of that and tell them how much they are out there because they don't see them, right? And I think like hiding them makes people not be ready to address them, right? You know what I mean? So that's another cost that we need to consider. And then you know, so when we do let, if we do let these people be stay on YouTube, is the whether or not the cost of them spreading those ideas is more than the cost of not letting them? I don't think that's an easy answer, and I think like we need a lot more data to be able to answer that. So I don't know.
Yeah, when it comes to like myself personally, like when I was like maybe 17 or so, when I first still in that like rebellious phase, and I remember that. What? I don't get that.
Oh no! Don't worry. That's not, people know. I'm just don't worry. You continue.
When I was in that kind of peak NTSJW phase, like for me, when you would ask me what do I think a feminist is, I had no idea what intersectionality. I didn't have no idea about like what kind of misogyny was present in society and stuff like that. To me, my only experience with feminists were what Milo was making fun of, or what Ben Shapiro would be like demolishing using facts and logic. You know, it's only later as I started looking into it more, but I started understanding more what intersectionality is, what kind of like, you know, systemic discrimination and all that stuff are, that I realized that a lot of the things that these people say is just nonsense, but they know how to phrase it and they know how to speak in a way that's appealing to people who just aren't educated on those topics. But yeah, I don't have an answer to what level the deplatforming is good or what level it's bad. I guess if I had to say, if we could come up with certain specific policies that we know for a fact would only target people with heinous views and with people who actually radicalize into like youngsters or whatever into harmful ideologies, then I'd be okay with it, but I don't know what those policies would be.
But I mean, heinous, you mean like, based on your standard, then we should ban religion on all these platforms. Like every single YouTube video that is teaching you about how great Islam or Christianity and Hinduism is, or Judaism is, they will all, based on that standard, they will all get removed. I mean, how do you decide how heinous, like where is the, like again, I don't think it's that easy to come up with these standards. You might as well, because it's so hard to come up with a line, you might as well just be like, you know what? Screw it and let everything, just everything apply. Yeah, go on.
That's why I'm not a free speech absolutist, because I feel like if you're a free speech absolutist, you have to make certain concessions that I don't think a reasonable person would make, because I feel like if you knew for a fact that someone saying just one particular speech would lead a whole, like say 1,000 youngsters to become like neo, you know, that way. I don't know I don't like saying it on YouTube, so I don't want to say the word, but if you know the fact that that speech would lead to people doing that, as a utilitarian, I'm sure you'd be okay with that one particular speech.
Yeah, but that's kind of saying that do you think murder should be murder? Do you think we should execute people without due process? And I'm like, no. But you're like, what if I come up with this specific example of this guy that you just know that they're about to like kill 1,000 people if you don't execute them, but there's no way that you could prove it in the court of law? Should we not like have like government secretly just erase this one specific person in the middle of the night because there's no other way to legally execute this person or put them in jail? Wouldn't this specific situation be good for us to just like, you just know that this person is going to like do an attack and is going to kill this many million people? And, you know, I mean, yeah, but I mean, we're not coming up with these like specific examples like that. We have to come up with certain like standards that work most of the time. We cannot come up, because if you come up with extreme examples, then you cannot have any standard, you know. If you come up with extreme examples, then every standard that you ever introduce anywhere at any point can be argued away by coming up with extreme examples. Do you know what I mean? Then you don't have any. I could come up with extreme examples from the other side, right? You know what I mean?
I'll try and put it in like a syllogistic form, but I'll fail because I'm not good at that, but I'll try. So let's say you come and say every speech should be allowed. And I bring up, what about this speech? To which you respond, well, you're finding an extreme example of like whatever. I'm testing you on your consistency. So it's, I'm addressing the argument that every speech should be allowed. But you
say, so what if I tell you that every single, every person, okay, who has been arrested should be proven guilty in the court of law before they're put in jail, right? And but you find an example where you just happen to know that this person, if he is let free, is going to do something that's going to kill a million people, right? But you can't prove it in the court of law. Should we, because of this extreme example, should we give up on this standard and be like, you know what, just remove this law altogether, because we could have what I'm saying is that we come up with standards and laws and codes of ethics and stuff not based on what works most of the time. You know what I mean? What works most of the time. For example, let's say we have the standard like, oh, when you see a red light, the law is you have to stop. You're driving, you have to stop behind the red light, right? And then you could say like, well, can't we have it that you have to stop, but what if it's like 2 a.m. and the driver can see that there's no pedestrians and there's no cars from 10, like it's flat and you can see from 10 kilometers away, there's no cars at all. And you're like waiting for like 5 minutes behind the red lights like an idiot. And you know that there's no consequences for you to drive through this. Nothing is going to happen. Okay. Should we not make it that? Should we not put that in the law? Should we be like, okay, you have to stop behind the red light unless you could be guaranteed, like if it's a 2 a.m. and there's no cars, then there's an exception that's legal for you to pass it. No, we don't come up with, because then every single standard would have to come up with, like every single standard you could throw it away if you come up with situations. You know, as a utilitarian, you understand, like if we had, utilitarianism doesn't work if you want to calculate the cost and benefit of every single action at every single minute, right? You have to understand as a utilitarian, the standards are not based on calculating the cost and benefits for every single action. You have to come up with standards that work most of the time because we don't have the capacity to calculate and come up with new rules. Like, imagine how complicated the legal system is already is, right? With as, but imagine if we wanted to come up with a law for every single situation, we had like a utility calculating machine that we had to run every single time. We get like, okay, oh, stealing is illegal. Well, unless you're starving and you're going to die, like, okay, let's put that in the law. Like, no, unless this, unless that, like the laws are already, the laws and standards are already complicated enough. Now, if you want, you can't, you cannot make it even worse by trying to come up with unique situations that don't apply most of the time. You have to at some point be like, look, this is not going to work all the time. Sometimes this law or this standard or this community standard, it's going to misfire a couple of times. But if we make this any more complicated, nobody's even going to be able to read it or follow it. This is works most of the time. We're going to go with this.
I feel like even in the law, there's always caveats for every law, right? Like, so all the utilitarian would have to do is that in the majority of cases, this standard should apply, but not like with free speech, for example. I'm very much for free speech, but I'm not a free speech absolutist. So I would say I recognize restrictions to free speech, but in the vast majority of cases, I think we should side with the against the censorship or like whatever.
That's not a restriction on free speech, though. If you even if I agree that, okay, this person needs to be deplatformed from Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube or whatever, that's not a violation of anyone's free speech. As long as it's not made to be illegal, that's censorship. And in general, I'm not an anti-censorship absolutist. You know, even if I am close to a free speech absolutist, me being in favor of censorship at sometimes, that doesn't make that... Censorship is not always a violation of free speech, especially if it's a, if I was like anti-censorship absolutist, then I would be like, oh yeah, like you're having a dinner with your family and then somebody just comes, crashes in and then just jumps on your dinner table and starts reading the Communist Manifesto. And you're like, dude, get the hell out. We're like, no, this is censorship. Like, dude, this is my house. I don't want you to be reading the Communist Manifesto in my house to my family. Get the hell out of my house. This is my house. You're like, nope. I demand an audience, and this, your family is now my audience, and you have to listen to me. No, you can censor this guy. This is your house. You can kick them out of your house. If I go to a church and start telling people like, hey, your God is fake, your guys are all idiots, and they kick me out of the church, it's their church. They own the church. They're like, ah, censorship, they kicked me out of their church. No, it's their platform. If they don't want me there, they could be like, they could kick me out of their church, okay? So being a free speech absolutist doesn't mean that you're an anti-censorship absolutist, right? Saying that you have the right to say whatever you want without any legal consequences, that doesn't mean that that right doesn't give you a right to an audience. Right? A right to freedom of speech doesn't mean that you have a right to every audience at all times.
Yeah, I would say that. I feel like we probably agree on this. Mm. Maybe the one point is that I would be open to... sorry, because you basically repeated what my take was, so I have to like find something new.
No, but okay, so we have to end this very soon because usually these goes for an hour, but this was
I have like a couple of stuff but within the same topic, but it's kind of like short.
Okay, let me just address this. John is saying, do you support freedom of religion? You recently said you shut down Catholic Church. No, I said I want the Catholic Church to be shut down, but this is the Catholic Church has done enough crimes for it to be shut down, not because of religion, but because of all the crimes that they have defended. If this was any other organization, they would have been shut down. This is not, they should be shut down not because I'm violating the freedom of religion. They should be shut down because we should be taking away their religious privilege, right? If this was a non-religious organization, it would have been shut down ages ago because of all the crimes that they're committing and defending. So yes, I am for shutting them down, but not because they are expressing their religion, but because their crimes, and because their only reason. Taking the reason why they're still not shut down is because they have religious privilege, right? So them being shut down is taking away their religious privilege. It's not taking away their religious freedom. But anyway, yeah, let's quickly go through these because...
Yeah, it's not that big. One thing that I kind of wonder... Yeah, I'm not making any claim here. It's just something I don't know what the answer is. I feel like... Do you think that on YouTube, at least, atheism is popular? Because I kind of noticed that back in 2015, every atheist YouTuber became anti-SJW. And nowadays, every atheist YouTuber is becoming a progressive. Like a progressive.
I've noticed a lot of them having more nuanced takes than before. It used to be like anti-SJW or as progressive. Now, I think some of them are like, you know what? I am more careful with my anti-SJW-ness. Like maybe there's some, I see the point of some of the other side, and some people that are progressive, they're like, they're coming more nuanced. They're like, okay, I see how some people on my side could be a little bit ridiculous. So I feel like both the some of the people that were anti-SJW and some of the people that were SJW themselves, I don't think people use that term anymore, right? They use woke or progressive. I feel like they're being a little bit more careful with the things that they want to endorse. Like I don't know, I see a lot of progressives that are saying like, yeah, I guess people are being racist. It's possible to be racist against white people and we should probably cut that out. And it's possible to be sexist against men. They used to say that's not even possible, but now they're saying it's possible and maybe we should cut it out. And then I think like that's what some progressives I noticed are saying. And I noticed a lot of people who are anti-SJW now saying like, yeah, I guess there's a bunch of people that are actually racist and actually homophobic and actually transphobic, and they're hiding their transphobia and their homophobia and their misogyny and their racism and under this pretense of, you know, they're hiding it under anti-SJW, but it's not anti-SJW. They're just genuinely racist. They're admitting that this is a problem on their side. So I feel like they're just growing, and they're like, they don't have, some of them have less binary black and white takes than they had before. So I think I see it as progress.
Yeah, I'll use one example. I know he's your friend, but I'm not insulting him, even though I'm not a fan of his work. Sargon of Akkad, like a few years ago, he was making arguments for the Enlightenment. I was watching one of his videos like some days back, and he is now arguing against the Enlightenment, and he's making pro-Christianity arguments. Like,
yeah, I debated him on that. Did you see that?
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I debated him on Christianity. I also talked to Vosh about this debate, you know, on platforming and deplatforming. You should watch that as well.
Yeah, I think I watched the Vosh one a while back. Yeah, I have one.
Search for Armin Navabi Sargon of Akkad Christianity.
I'll look it up. But yeah, it's something with Vosh, but I kind of wonder. So I enjoy his like debates when he's debating alt-writers or like incels and stuff like that. My only worry with him is that I feel like he's not de-radicalizing extremists on the right. He's just taking the hatred and replacing it with all this stuff that he agrees with. So he's not de-radicalizing them. He's just re-radicalizing them. He's, because so many people who are far right now are becoming like communists.
I think he's de-radicalizing communists, to be honest.
Vosh?
Yeah.
He's like the furthest... he's not a tanky, but he's like uncom, right?
No, but I think like all the things that we don't like about a lot of far lefty people, he's helping us. Okay, so for like a lot of people who are part of the Wokistani Mujahideen, they would never listen to somebody like me, okay? But they do listen to somebody like Vash, right? And what if they keep following Vash, what is Vash telling them? Vash is telling them that, yeah, you know, religion is cringe, including Islam, right? And if he's like anti-Islam, he thinks that he might not think like anti-white racism is as common as maybe I think it is, but he calls it out and he thinks it's a real thing that exists, and that's that he calls it out as like race, like actual racism, right? So he doesn't dismiss it when he sees it and he calls it out. He thinks anti-male sexism is a real thing, and when he sees it, he calls it out. Even though maybe he doesn't think it's as big of a deal as it actually is. He's against protectionism, which is amazing. Like this whole idea of like, imagine this, like a whole bunch of like lefty people, like very lefty people being introduced to the idea of trade, more trade being a good thing. And you know, this whole, and one thing that people are afraid of, becoming popular among far lefty people is this, is their thirst for a violent revolution. Mm-hmm. And that is such a red line for a lot of them that that I think anybody that wants to make sure that they have an audience with them, that, you know, that if you take away the hope in the revolution away from them, they will completely abandon you, right? This is kind of like their, you know, Muslims have their end of times, Hindus have their version, Christians have their versions, and I think like a lot of people, a lot of communists have this one wishing for the revolution. That's the thing that they cling to the most. So you can't really take that away from them. But I think what Vash does with them is tell them that now it's not the time, right? The conditions are not met. Now you have to play ball with democracy. You have to, liberals are bad. Liberals are bad, but to get our way, we have to work with them. So it's kind of like making them, you know, work within the liberal system, work within the democratic society, not, you know, not do violent revolution, because maybe one day, okay? So like just post that hope for like some future that nobody knows when it's gonna happen. It's gonna happen one day, maybe within, not, you know, like just put that somewhere that they could just wish for it, but it's never going to actually happen. But right now, they're going to encourage them more to work. I don't know if I knew, if I didn't know any better, I would think that he's actually a liberal, right? That is pretending to be a leftist. I know that's not true. Like, he is a genuine leftist, not a liberal. But if somebody was an actual liberal who wanted to pretend to be a leftist to like make all of these crazy communists work within a liberal system, Vash would be it, right? Like this is what you would do. You would do what Vash is doing. So I think he's having a major de-radicalization effect on a lot of people on the left. So.
Yeah, that's fair. And like a final, the last point that I wanted to bring up, it's nothing serious, it's something I've been thinking about. You know who James Randi is, right?
Yeah, of course.
So James Randi recently passed away, and mm-hmm. I saw a lot of people talking about how James Randi influenced them into becoming skeptics and like YouTubers. But when I look at those people content, like, James Randi was debunking people like Yuri Geller, Peter Popoff, who are like magicians who pretend they aren't doing tricks and stuff like that. But those YouTubers who are skeptics are debunking political takes. They are like, they're doing like, over talking about atheism and stuff like that, which James Randi never really, I mean, he gave his opinions on religion, he's an atheist and all, but his work was about debunking frauds who were pretending to have magical powers and stuff. But none of the skeptic YouTubers that I know, other than maybe Nate Talks to You or like Jeff Holiday, other than these two, and maybe Thunderfoot, but Thunderfoot is kind of sketchy sometimes with his obsession on Anita Sarkeesian. But other than him, but other than these few people, few others are actually doing skepticism. They just do politics.
I think, let me see who's doing skepticism. Rationality Rules is good. Unfortunately, he just recently came out with a video that said that YouTube is now doesn't like if you want to tackle conspiracy theories, YouTube will consider you as spreading conspiracy theories because YouTube's algorithm is dumb, and so it's not worth it anymore for him to tackle conspiracy theories. But I think Rationality Rules would have been the best alternative to that right now.
Do you know who's like the best one I've seen? There's a guy called Potholer 54. Have you heard of him?
No. But I seriously need to go because now
that's all I was going to say.
Okay, I just want to highlight this crazy this is so crazy that it's beautiful. Okay, so Animax Element saying Iranians think they are Europeans. That. No, actually, Iranians used to clean toilets of Vedic Indians, and then they left to West because they got more toilet cleaning jobs in Babylon. Oh God, this is
what the fuck is that?
This is probably if I would guess is that this is like a Hindutva person that I don't know what that doesn't like Persian people, and he's coming with his version of history. Okay, it's just so beautiful how much crazy. It's just I don't know. Morta to say, oh my God, yes, I don't know what that's referring to. I think maybe Rationality Rules. Oh no, okay, so Hindutva Power saying
that's a big fan of Sadhguru.
Hold on. If you don't understand Hinduism or Sanatana Dharma, watch Sadhguru. Oh my God, watch Sadhguru. Otherwise, you might waste all your 7 births without even knowing the truth. Wow. We have Hindutva Power. Don't worry. We watch Sadhguru a lot on Atheist Republic. He's a great source of comedy. That guy is ridiculously stupid. And his points are... Okay, Hindutva Power, the fact that you think Sadhguru is a source of wisdom makes me know everything I need to know about you. Yeah.
One thing about your videos on Sadhguru was, Pothole 54. One thing that, so your videos about Sadhguru was what my dad told me, like, I know you're an atheist and all now, but watch Sadhguru. He has like atheistic content because he says that he doesn't opine on whether gods exist or not. I showed my mom some of what you said about him, and my mom was like, yeah, Sadhguru is a moron,
yeah. I mean, technically, he's a genius that takes advantage of morons, though. But we do a lot of live streams on Sadhguru. It's just so much. Oh my God! Whenever we want to have a laugh, we do a live stream on Sadhguru. Anyways, I really have to go. Nature calls. But this was very interesting, very fun. I like it. Yeah, I like
it. Yeah, it was really fun. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, yeah. And again, guys, if you guys want to schedule a call with me, there's a link for it in the description. Just says schedule a call with Armin. And what else? Oh yeah, subscribe right now. And if you're watching this on Atheist Republic, subscribe to my personal channel where we stream this, link in the description. Or you could just follow us on Twitch, which all of our live streams, whether if it's on Armin Navabi's channel or the Atheist Republic channel, we always try to stream on Twitch if Twitch allows us. So follow us on Twitch as well. And Vikram, did you want to tell people anything? Closing remarks, just short.
Not really. I don't do I'm a private person, but
okay, cool. All right, guys. Thank you for everybody here. And Ghostman is saying love everyone. This person is saying wait, I can't wait. I have to go. All right, talk to you guys later. Bye. One second.